Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 164. I'm your host, Chris Webster, with my co-host, Paul Zimmerman. Today, we talk about the science behind the human footprints reported on from New Mexico this week. Let's get to it. All right, welcome to the show, everybody. Paul, how's it going?
It is going okay right now. You know, I've lamented the last couple of times I've been on that I've been, well, not exactly lamenting, but I've been commenting that I've been unemployed. So I've been using that time to study and to work on projects and fix things around the house. And yesterday morning, I got a really interesting phone call. So I have a job.
Fantastic.
Very short-term one, just a 1 week gig, but it's ideal for me. It's located about half an hour north of where I live. And it's just going to be 1 week, all of next week, doing shovel tests in a field in some partially wooded areas. So, you know, hopefully this opens the door for me. I'm thrilled, excited about the opportunity. But boy, last night I slept terribly. I had anxiety dreams about everything I could possibly do wrong. In my dreams, I pissed off the field director. I pissed off everybody that I was working with. God. I pissed off the landowner. I slept in the wrong room in the house. Just everything. So hopefully I got that out of my system. And next week will be much more enjoyable than last night was.
Well, this is actually on par with the Archaeotech Podcast because, you know, people don't realize the science. I think people who aren't in archaeology, they may not realize the science behind shovel testing and why we do it and the interval shovel testing. And what state are you shovel testing in?
It'll be in New York.
New York. Now, have they told you anything about the size of the shovel tests or the interval that you're shovel testing on yet?
Yeah. Actually, I got a really good document explaining everything about what the strategy was going to be, where we were living, who all was on the project. It's a small one. It's four people. And again, it should be done in 4 to 5 days.
Yeah.
But what I was happy was he explained in that document the exact, you know, what we're going to be doing in terms of shovel tests, the intervals and the size and the depth. And it matched exactly what I dug up previously when I was looking at the state regulations or guidelines rather for shovel tests. So I read one thing and then I had to confirm someplace else. And that made me feel really proud of my research abilities.
Are they 30 centimeter round or 50 by 50 square?
They are in New York. It's round 30 to 50 centimeters and then down to sterile soil.
Okay. Gotcha. And then the other thing you got to find out, because companies do this differently, is are you digging stratigraphically, which means to anybody who doesn't know this, are you digging until you hit a soil change and that's a level and everything is cataloged within that level artifact wise? Or are you digging in 10 centimeter levels arbitrarily or 20 centimeter levels or whatever the case may be? I'm curious as to that as well.
That was not explained in the document, and that's not in the in the guidelines for the state. So I'll find out exactly when I meet the project director on Monday. I'll find out exactly how they want to go about that, and then I will do whatever they tell me.
Cool. Yeah. There's a lot of interesting methodologies out there for how to do things. When we were in North Carolina doing shovel testing one time on a massive 2,000 acre project that took months to shovel test and literally tens of thousands of shovel tests, it was just insane. We were doing sometimes 70 to 80 shovel tests a day. And the reason is it was all dry sand. And that sand was one level. And they weren't, it was so churned because it's the coastal plain. It's churned up by hurricanes literally every year. And, you know, when the trees started moving into, you know, the coast has moved out through time since the last glacial maximum because, I'm sorry, the coast has moved in, I guess, through time. And, but trees have ebbed and flowed, and sometimes you've got a shoreline, sometimes you don't, you know, all kinds of different things. So because of that, hurricanes come in, and even miles and miles inland, they can really churn up and drop a lot of sand and then take a lot of sand as well with the outwash. So things move around quite a bit. And we had one stratigraphic layer that was over a meter deep. And with a shovel test, you're hard pressed to get down more than a meter most of the time, you know, maybe a little more than a meter, but you just can't reach. Even if you're trying, you just can't reach. So we dig out in 30 centimeter diameter shovel test, we dig out the entire shovel test into your screen because it's all one layer. And then sometimes you just lift up your screen and you're just left with a pile of pottery or nothing. Yeah. That's case maybe. And it was super fast. It was super fast. You catalog it. If you found nothing, I had timed myself down to about 5.5 to 6.5 minutes if there were negative shovel tests from the time I was sighting in my next one to the time I was sighting in the one after that. So that includes paperwork, backfill, you know, setup and digging the shovel test. And it was just, it was backbreaking work, literally backbreaking work, man. So
I'm curious about shovel tests. And this is probably way aside from our intended topic, but do you tend to work like as small teams, or do you do it individually? Is like one person in charge of recording while the other person's in charge of digging, or do you basically do it soup to nuts, you know, recording measurements and digging, recording and all by yourself?
I've done both. Typically when it's 30 bys and it's easy soil, you're one person because it doesn't really take two people to do that. When it's harder to dig soil and bigger shovel tests, then I've often worked in teams. I worked in teams in Vermont. That's why I asked, because I haven't worked in New York, but I have worked in Vermont, and that clay up there, the Vergennes clay, they called it, was really tough. And sometimes a single shovel test would take hours because they were 50 by 50. You're going down a meter plus with that. And sometimes it would take 2-3 hours just to do one shovel test. And that's with one person. In one case, I was working with a partner and we were asked on a site. It was a site that we were doing close interval testing on. We were asked to basically get a soil profile of the site. So we were asked to go down way further than everybody else, just arbitrarily, even though we were negative, to see what it looks like. And both of us were screening at that point because you would take... It was raining too. So you would take a couple scoops of just sloppy clay into your screen. And then you'd basically use your rubber gloved hands to form it into a loaf. And then I would basically slice it with my trowel because it wouldn't go through the screen.
Right.
It wouldn't push through. So you're just like slicing it thinly with your trowel, hoping to hit something like a point or something like that, or a flake. And it was horrific. But in the end, it really depends on how quickly does the shovel test get excavated. If it's super fast to dig and super fast to screen, there's no reason for two people. If it's a little bit slower because the soil takes longer to push through the screen, then you might have two people where there's one shovel in the hole and two screens, and you're just both working on it to get it out. So just depends on the area. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll find out when I get the initial meet and greet on Monday. But I, you know, because it's so close to where I live, I have a pretty good expectation of what the soil is going to be like. I've seen historic aerial photographs of the area, and it used to all be farmland. So I'm expecting, you know, a top layer of plow zone and loam, and then maybe another layer underneath. The only thing is, like in my yard, if I try to dig, the frost heaves are everywhere, just lots of cobble rocks, everything, you know, so it takes a long time to dig. To get around the rocks, right? So that might slow us down. The soil itself shouldn't be as clayey as what you had up in Vermont. But again, we'll see, because this is, you know, it is half an hour farther north from me, and it is closer into the Taconic Mountains than I am.
Yep.
So similar, but it's going to be its own thing.
You're definitely going to want a nice bastard file to keep your shovel really sharp to cut through those roots. Sometimes you even want a pair of garden clippers, like hand clippers, to get the roots. Unless you're just moving quicker than that. It just depends on the team and what the goal is. But if you can get it, honestly, if you can get it with your shovel, a nice sharp shovel, and just slice through those things without destroying your sidewalls, then you're good to go. But if sometimes you got to get down there and you've got a big root that just crosses over your shovel test, then hopefully they've got loppers out there. And loppers, like the big hand loppers, you know, usually somebody ends up calling one of them Cindy, and then they say, hey, pass me Cindy, because Cindy loppers.
So. Yes, that's the lopper that I have for our garden work. That's its name. I thought I was being so unique.
Oh, no. Yeah, so Cindy's on every project in the East.
Well, that's good. I'll have to make sure I put a file in my toolkit and some clippers and also Cindy.
And Cindy, yeah. Now, they should have some of that stuff. Like the loppers, I would imagine the company would bring out, including a file, too. But having your own is just comforting because, you know, you don't have to rely on somebody else. And often at break time, that's what I do is just sharpen my shovel while I sit there and, you know, drink coffee and have a snack or something like that. So, but all right. So 10 minutes into the show, let's talk about our topic.
So, well, we had to put the brakes on this topic because it's been the buzz for the last couple of days.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And speaking of excavation and shovel testing, they have been excavating at White Sands National Park in New Mexico, which is, I guess, kind of in the southeastern corner of New Mexico.
It looks like South Central, maybe.
South Central. Yeah, it's huge. Yeah. Whatever it is. It's massive. Yeah. And they've been digging there for a really, really long time. Now, something that I haven't seen mentioned, because this is going to come up when we talk about carbon-14 dating later, but I wanted to mention it now because I just thought about it. I haven't heard mention of the nuclear testing that was done there back in the 40s and 50s.
Right.
Because
it's right next to the proving grounds.
Exactly. Exactly. Everything in that area has been affected from a carbon-14 standpoint. So let's remember to talk about that when we get to the carbon-14 section of this podcast. But first, to just lay the groundwork, we've got some really great links in the show notes for this episode. And the first one is going to be the actual science article. Now, it's paywalled, so most of you probably can't get to it. We can't get to it. But there are some other really good articles from Scientific American and Science News that actually they have access to it and they've talked about it. But this article in Science is called Evidence of Humans in North America During the Last, During, not After, During the Last Glacial Maximum. And it's authored by Matthew Bennett, who is of Bournemouth University, I believe, in the UK, and 10 other authors. So it says plus 11 authors. So I think that they're displaying 5 plus 11. I don't know if that means 16 authors or what. But anyway, a lot of people had a hand in this. And that speaks to why this is on the Archaeotech podcast. Now, this sounds like an archaeology show article where we're just going to talk about something in the news. But there are so many other disciplines that have been brought in to help analyze and interpret what they're finding here. And that's what finally put the nail in the coffin for them to be able to say, hey, here's what we have, let's publish. Because the stuff we're going to talk about, these footsteps, these trackways, they've been known about for a really long time. Like they found them decades ago and they keep finding them. Like I think I wrote in my notes, they found there's at least 7 distinct trackways and one of them has like 37 prints on it in that one alone. And they found all these through excavation. Let's just get down to exactly what this is. These are human footprints. They look like human feet. They're anatomically human feet and they're footprints. Now, this was on the edge of an ice age lake, a lake that's no longer there. That's a desert now. And White Sands is an actual desert. And it sounds like it would have been a beautiful like lake edge. I'm imagining the black sand beaches of Hawaii, but the exact opposite of that, like pure white sand beaches, which are always really cool because that's what's here now. And presumably that's what was there back in the day, 20,000 plus years ago. So the glacial maximum, the LGM, they call it the last glacial maximum, which was, you know, there's been lots of glacial maximums, which is basically the furthest extent, the thickest ice, of the glaciers that came down from the north. This was the height of that. And it was thought that nobody could really get here during that time because it would have been too brutal, right? They could have come over the ice, the Bering Land Bridge. The bridge was created by ice and by the sucking up of the oceans into that ice and actually exposing land in some cases that wasn't there before because the oceans were lower because it was all ice. So, you know, with that, it would have just been extremely brutal. So other theories have come around as the glaciers started to recede, that people have come down through on the coast through boats, you know, living off sea life and things like that, still coming through Alaska. There's other theories of people coming across the Pacific and things like that. But specifically here for North America, all kinds of theories for how people have come through. And then there's the ice-free corridor, because as the glaciers started to recede, I think it was the Wisconsin Glacier, they call it, that covered the Great Lakes. And then there's I don't remember what it was called, but there's like a Pacific Glacier over here, and then a ice-free corridor in the middle, because that somehow, for whatever reason, melted first and, you know, would have brought back in wildlife and vegetation and things people can live off of, so creating a corridor. But these people left these footsteps during that maximum, and it's been thought that just wasn't possible. And right. It's possible for people to get here then, which means if that's true, they came here well before then. Like well before then. I mean, had to have been thousands of years before the 21 to 23,000 years that this was dated to. What do you think about all this, Paul?
You know, what we were trained for decades now, that the most solid evidence for people in the Americas is, you know, the Clovis people, if it's, mm-hmm. you can consider a distinct culture. So around 13,000 years ago, and that's during that period of that ice-free corridor. And the argument is that they crossed the Bering Land Bridge, got into the ice-free corridor, and then populated the Americas via this inland route. There's long been argument that that there could also be, like you were just saying, a coastal route. Mm-hmm. During these ice ages, especially, you know, like during this last glacial maximum. But the evidence for that has been problematic.
Right.
There are a number of sites that are purported to be pre-Clovis, but there's always questions around, you know, is the evidence actually human made? Mm-hmm. And this one here is the first thing that we have that is absolutely undeniably human. I mean, these are footprints. So yeah. As opposed to the other sites, things like Monteverde down in Chile, which, if I recall, is around 17,000 years ago, mm-hmm. and would have supported that coastal migration theory. Mm-hmm. The questions for those are these things made by people? This one here, it's definitely, these are people that made these footprints. The questions going forward are going to be about the dating. And I think right. that's where you and I are going to discuss a little bit, the tech of this, a little bit about the C14. But it's fascinating. Yeah. I mean, again, this blew up my Twitter feed yesterday. And actually, I'll put in the show notes a nice thread by Dr. Jennifer Raff, who discusses this and finds it. She argues it's quite compelling. Her specialty is genetics. And so she throws in a few extra wrinkles from her point of view that are questions that are raised by this and a teaser mm-hmm. for an upcoming article or book. And wow, you know, all the cool things yeah. always have more questions afterwards. They cause yeah. more questions than necessarily the answer. But if the dating is right, this is the first absolutely positively unambiguous pre-Clovis evidence of people in the Americas.
And with that, let's go to break and we're going to get deeper into the actual dating, and because you can't date footprints, but you could date the stuff around it. So let's talk about that on the other side of the break. Back in a minute.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Shovel Testing with Chris and Paul. No, that's not the name of the show. Let's welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 164. No, we're diving back into this footprints thing. So let me talk about the footprints themselves, right? Like, because like I said at the end of the last segment, you can't date footprints. There's nothing there. I mean, honestly, if it weren't the desert, and maybe if we had some better technology, I'm not really sure about decay rates and how the stuff breaks down, but these people were barefoot. So presumably there would have been, and they're barefoot standing on sand, and everybody knows that sand destroys your feet. So presumably there's skin cells and all kinds of stuff that were left behind at the time that they were walking on this beach. But I don't know how that stuff would have lasted over the last 20,000 years, if we could even get something like DNA. I mean, I know we don't really have the technology now, or that's what we'd be talking about, but is it there? Does it just break down in that desert dry environment? Did it break down in the wet environment that was there to begin with? Who knows? It's the kind of thing that probably doesn't last very long. And we couldn't really date that anyway. I don't think there'd be enough carbon 14 in those cells. Maybe there is, I don't know, to actually date those from that standpoint. But genetically, you can look at gene sequences and you can kind of genetically date stuff, right? By looking at the clock changes in how DNA has changed over time, you can look back and say, okay, we've got this DNA. How does that compare to today's DNA and how we know mutation rates change? And then you can kind of use the genetic clock, they call it, to do that. I don't know a whole lot about that. But that's not what they did here. What they did here was they did what's called, they basically used either archaeobotany, depending on who you talk to. The Brits like calling it archaeobotany because their archaeology department is separate from anthropology in Europe and the UK. Over here in the United States, archaeology is a subfield of anthropology and within the anthropology department at most universities. And we tend to prefer the term in this country of ethnobotany or paleoethnobotany. I mean, ethnobotany is a thing. That's just the study of, I think, like humans and plants, right? But paleoethnobotany is a study of ancient humans and ancient plants. So this is really cool. There's a plant called I wrote it down here.
The spiral ditch grass.
Yes, the spiral ditch grass. So I actually didn't even look that up to see what it looks like. If it's still around today, I'm sure it is. But a plant called the spiral ditch grass that was prevalent in that area and around the lake edge there. And yeah, the
growing up ditch grass meant something totally different.
Exactly. And the seeds from that, of course, litter the whole area, you know, because plants just deposit their seeds. When it breaks down, seeds have these shells on them typically, and they last forever in the archaeological record. I mean, not forever, but for a really long time. And there's actual seeds from this plant that are in the footsteps that were crushed by the people walking on them, which to me, I love seeing any intersection between a thing I can hold in my hands or look at and an actual human, especially 20,000 years ago. That just really makes it real. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. When you're looking at a piece of flake stone or something like that, or even a flake itself, you're like in the back of your mind, you're like 90% a human made this, but 10% nature could have made this. Were there really humans here 3,000 years ago? That kind of thing. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know. But when you've got a projectile point or you've got something like this where it's actually in the footprint of a human, that's super cool. So since you can't actually date the footprints, at least not yet, they dated these seeds. Now, they excavated down to find this stuff too, and I can't remember how far they excavated, but they have seeds on top, they have seeds below, and they were able to bracket the footprints with these seeds and use carbon 14 to date them.
Yeah, I was actually a little confused by where the seeds were found because I read a bunch of different things in different commentary, and unfortunately, because like we said at the start, neither of us could get our hands on the actual paper.
Right.
But some places it sounded like just what you said, that they were embedded in the footprints, these seeds were. So in direct contact to the human that made the footprints.
Yeah.
And then very, very firmly datable. Others said that they were in layers above and below, and that's a common method of dating things in archaeology, terminus postquem, terminus antiquem. You bracket what's in between. And so you have something that's datable above and something datable below, and that in-between layer. Oh, and I don't know if we mentioned it, but there are multiple different levels, different layers with footprints that they excavated, and they did the same process through. So it spans a couple thousand years, the entirety of this site that they've so far uncovered. But then another thing I read, another commentary said, I don't trust the dates particularly because they were found 50 meters away from in associate context. That is, you know, in a layer that you could trace. But if it's 50 meters away, that makes it less secure. I don't know what the reality of this is. What I've been reading so far gives me three different pictures that go from best embedded in the footprints to not quite as good, but still pretty good, you know, bracketing to a little more problematic bracketing, but, you know, not in direct context with those footprints, not very close to them, but quite a distance away. Jeez, this is the stuff that drives me crazy when things are paywalled because, you know, this is something that if I read the article, I'd know where they actually found them, but I don't.
Right. So let me use Africa as an example here, because I'm very familiar with this stratigraphic dating technique, as most archaeologists are. But my first real exposure to this and understanding of it was talking about paleoanthropology in Africa. So every I've been to Olduvai Gorge. I've excavated in Olduvai Gorge. And the trench that I helped excavate was dated to between 1.81 million and 2.01 million years old. How do I know that, right? Well, the way I know that is because that East African area, the Rift Valley, they call it, was highly geologically and volcanically active for millions and millions and millions of years, including the time before and after when early hominids were living in that area. So you would have these not necessarily volcanic explosions, although those did happen. The footprints that were the Laetoli trackway, they call it, that has hominid footprints that date to, I'm not going to pull the right date out, but somewhere around 2 to 3 million years old. The Laetoli trackway, which is south of Olduvai Gorge, I believe, that is a result of humans walking on soft, like clay soil, and then immediately getting covered by ash, which presumably the hominids probably didn't make it either, because there was a volcano nearby exploding rapidly and covering everything as they made those steps. And there's all kinds of other animals that were fleeing as well, and their footprints are there as well. But a lot of times you'd get these flows of lava that just covered the landscape. And I mean, just covered the landscape like Hawaii in volcanic rock. They use a number of dating methods, but one of the most prevalent ones for volcanic basalt is called potassium-argon dating. And it's basically, I might get it wrong, but one of those, I believe it's potassium, is in the rock when it's created and it decays, because most elements decay. It decays, like radioactive decay, they call it, just like carbon-14, which we're going to talk about. It decays into argon. And if you can measure the ratio of those two that's left, you can date the rock. So they can't date any of the hominid fossils that are out there. Anything that's found in Olduvai Gorge is dated by stratigraphically dating the volcanic layers. Now, you may not find a hominid fossil in direct association with the lava flows. It might be miles away in some other part of the gorge, but you have a stratigraphic representation of the entire Olduvai Gorge. And you know that, hey, even though I can't see the lava right here, I can see the stratigraphic layers, and I know that this fossil fits within this structure right here. So the fact that the footprints in some cases may have been found 50 meters away from stratigraphically distinct layers where the seeds were found doesn't shock me. That's common, especially around a lake edge, because lakes are very uniform in laying down sediment. And if you can really see the lines, and again, it would be really helpful to see the paper so we can see the profiles that they undoubtedly have in the paper. But if you can see the stratigraphic profile, it's more than likely really distinct. And if you find something here and 50, 100 meters, even a mile away, if you find something over here, but you've got the same layer cake structure, you can be pretty confident that it's in the same layer.
Oh yeah. I didn't mean to imply that pokes a hole in it. I just meant that not being able to read the primary documentation myself, I don't have any real way of assessing. I mean, I don't know if that's true, but even if it is true that's what happened, I don't have any way of using my own professional judgment to assess if this was done right or not.
Sure.
Yeah. For now, I'm willing to trust the authors of the paper, because it really looks like they did a good job. And I've yet to see, now maybe it's sampling bias because I've gotten most of my information from other archaeologists on Twitter, but I've yet to see any serious questions about this paper, about the data presented in it.
Yeah.
I am glad that you mentioned the animal tracks at Laetoli, because that's something else that can be used for dating in the White Sands case, is that it's not just human prints that are preserved there, but also prints of now extinct megafauna. So we know that this is old, right? It has to be at least from the extinctions of megafauna, which is around, 13 to 11,000? I don't know which ones in particular disappeared when.
Yeah, it wasn't uniform, of course, but yeah.
Yeah, so it's strong evidence that, yes, these human footprints are very, very old. And then again, the questions get into the weeds, kind of, no pun intended, about the spiral ditch grass. Or maybe a slight pun intended. get into the weeds of how the data were collected and how the radiocarbon dates were processed and analyzed. And, you know, and there are issues always around radiocarbon dates, issues of contamination, issues about calibration. Maybe we want to talk a little bit about just Do you want to give our listeners, I'm sure most of them already know this, but a quick primer on C14 dating?
Yeah. So the way this works, carbon 14, and it's usually 14, a little superscript 14. It's an isotope of carbon, like the regular carbon that you know. And carbon 14 is created when cosmic rays hit the atmosphere. Cosmic rays just mean stuff from space, the sun, you know, rays coming into the atmosphere, interacts with atmospheric nitrogen, and basically carbon dioxide, basically carbon, radioactive carbon dioxide is created. Now, through photosynthesis, plants are to blame for all this, right? So plants, yes, absorb all of this carbon 14. Animals and humans eat plants, and humans eat animals, and animals eat other animals, and all this carbon 14 is brought into the body. Well, the ratio of the amount of carbon 14 in the atmosphere is a number that you need to know in order to be able to calculate this, right? So mm-hmm. we use things like trees and like tree rings and ice cores and stuff like that to measure the amount that should be at that time period, whatever time period you're looking at. That's why these dates are called calibrated dates, right? It's calibrated mm-hmm. against something else that we do have a solid time frame for. And we have tree ring dating that goes back, you know, many thousands of years really yeah. in different areas, because the amount of carbon 14 in the atmosphere is also different regionally and in different periods of time. So it's a really complicated table to put whatever you're trying to date into. But basically, any radioactive element decays, and it decays on what's called a half-life. And what that means is, and I wrote in my notes here, is 5,730 years for carbon 14. So every 5,730 years, whatever carbon 14 was there, now half of it is gone, right? It's decayed into something else. And I can't remember actually what it decays into.
I think it's carbon 12
I'm
embarrassed that I can't remember. I think it's just carbon 12, which is a stable isotope. But you need to know two things at a minimum: what the proportion was originally mm-hmm. of the carbon 14 to carbon 12, and then what you currently have.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So what you currently have is dependent on the age primarily of the sample that you're taking. Mm-hmm. But then there are other factors involved in the collection and the processing of it. Yeah. What you originally had is what you were talking about before, that moving target. And so with the understanding that it's not constant through time, the amount of generation of that carbon 14 in the upper atmosphere isn't always uniform. There have been a lot of projects over the years, and you mentioned tree ring dating. And mm-hmm. so I'm just going to drop a name here. Henry Michael, who mm-hmm. was at MASCA, where I worked as a grad student, he was probably the most important researcher in charge of getting carbon calibration curves for bristlecone pines. And bristlecone pines, of course, can go to a very old age. And so using them and looking at the tree rings and matching up from one sample to another, from one tree to another, he pushed this the dating chronologically way back in time, but then also took samples of the various tree rings to show the kind of ebbs and flows of that relative proportion of C14 to C12.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, nice.
Yeah, so we have a long, C14 was, dating was developed in the 40s, and we've been calibrating it with various methods from the 50s onwards. Mm-hmm. And constantly refining it. But we constantly find additional kinds of problems. Like in reading this, you actually put in our show notes something that I had to go reread because it was something I did not know about as a potential problem with, and I'm trying to find the name. Do you have the reservoir name on hand? You see, reservoir effect. Thank you. I still don't get it. Do you know what that is?
Well, it has to do with aquatic plants, because if you've ever heard of a carbon sink, like the ocean is a huge carbon sink. Like a lot of our carbon dioxide and stuff like that is essentially just sucked up by the ocean, right? And so as it's one of the things that's actually limiting climate change for us, is because we have so much ocean. If we had less ocean, we probably would have had runaway greenhouse effect, you know, centuries ago, millennia ago, if not. So, but because we have so much water in the ocean and the plant life, it just soaks up so much more carbon, including carbon 14. So aquatic plants tend to have a higher than normal amount of carbon 14 than other things around it, which means the beings that are eating these plants and thereby the seeds that these guys actually dated would have a higher than normal carbon 14 amount than, say, things even just like a short distance away from the lake. Or that weren't aquatic plants. So I don't really know the chemistry behind why and how it absorbs more. It's just that it does, right? So, but apparently the article I read in, I think, Scientific American said that the authors actually, they knew about that, of course, and they took this into account when they were doing their dating methods. So I'd really, again, the paper would help, but I'd really like to see the error bars on their date range. They did say 21 to 23,000 years. I don't know if that's dating layers or if that really is the error bar range that they're putting in there. And, you know, what was the, because the paper would show what the actual date was without calibration, mm-hmm. right? The uncalibrated right. date. I'd like to see what that is and then see what the calibrated date is, because the calibrated date would take into account all the things we've talked about, plus this reservoir effect.
I don't know if we can post it because actually, you know what? It's I got it from the Jennifer Raff Twitter thread that, and I think this comes directly out of the article itself, but there's a schematic representation of the different layers and the numbers of footprints and the megafauna footprints as well. But then it shows on the left side of this schematic of the layers of the site, it shows the age ranges. And so the earliest date there is 22.86 plus or minus 0.32 thousand years ago. So that's your error bar right there, the 0.32 thousand years. So 300 years, basically. And the latest dates, 21.13 plus or minus 0.25 kilo anna. I don't even know I know what it means, but it's thousands of years ago. Okay. So it looks like they have that pretty tightly bound with those error bars. Again, assessing the accuracy, assessing the quality of their data is well beyond my skill.
Yeah.
But it looks pretty good.
Cool. All right. Well, let's take our final break and we'll wrap up this discussion on the other side and talk about tiny humans, which I have a problem with. Back in a minute.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 164, and we are talking about the earliest datable human footprints in the Americas, found in New Mexico. In the news as of September 24th, 2021, when we're recording this, although it came out probably a day or two ago, I didn't see what actually the paper was dated to, but it had to have been this week because it just blew everything up. Now, let's talk about the footprints themselves. Gets a little away from tech, but I gotta talk about it because I don't know what I think about it. And again, the paper may help, but basically the summary I saw and the piece that was pulled out by the journalist who wrote this, I think again in Scientific American, said that, you know, they were pulling from the article and they said that a lot of the human footprints are smaller in stature, which indicates, and you can tell that by measuring the foot, right? If you take an average of all the measurements, now some people have bigger feet than others. Some people have smaller feet than others. I don't know how my feet compare to my 6'1" size, but you know, there's variability there. But if you take an average, and they have many, 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 many prints to do this with. So if you take an average, you can kind of tell, okay, what are these footprints look like? Well, they're assuming these are anatomically modern humans, and they're assuming that they're of same proportions as we are today. Like we should be no different than Homo sapiens of 20,000 years ago. We should be no different really than, not that much, than Homo sapiens 100,000 years ago, right? There just hasn't been that much change in our DNA to have morphological changes like that that we could actually see. So the conclusion, according to the article I read, not the paper, is that they were smaller statures suggest adolescents and children. And I'm like, how many people, and I don't care what species you are, I don't care what species of human you are, I don't care how old and how long ago you lived, if your child runs towards the water, you're going to run after them. And, you know, that's just a parental instinct, right? Like, you're going to do that. Now, you know, back in the day, and I spent time in Africa where 5-year-olds were part of a group, you know, guarding sheep against lions. So obviously, historically, people weren't so helicoptery with their children. But that being said, I'd like to know the proportion of these, quote, adolescents and children to actual adults, because there has to be adult footprints represented in this. And if there is, I'll buy the argument for a lot of these being adolescent and children footprints, because maybe the adults were, you know, working, maybe there's a village nearby that hasn't been found yet. Maybe they're, you know, small camps. They didn't have villages probably, but smaller camps where they're doing stuff, they're processing food, they're doing whatever, and the kids are playing by the water. That totally makes sense to me. And that's where the footprints would have been preserved. They wouldn't necessarily have been preserved in the loose, dry sand that is up away from the water's edge, right? So that I would get. But just saying they're smaller because they're all smaller, I don't know. I feel like I need more evidence. There are smaller humans. Homo floresiensis was found in Indonesia. Now, that's many thousands of years older than this, but, you know, they're developed on an island, and island dwarfism is a thing. They're going to be smaller on an island. And these hominids were smaller on an island. So I don't know. What do you think, Paul?
Looking at that same chart that I was telling you about, that same graphic from the article, they show the range based off of the, presumably the foot size, and also where possible if the gait length, mm-hmm. right? Which is another indication of how tall somebody is.
Yeah.
You have to take into account like the speed that they're moving, because, you know, your gait's going to be a lot longer if you're at full sprint than if you're, you know, ambling along slowly. Mm-hmm. But the upper height of all the samples that they have is 1.5 meters and higher. So we've got 1.8 meters in TH1, the lowest level, and in TH3 and TH4, two of the middle layers here, they have maximum height of the individuals would be about 1.9 meters, which is taller than I am. So I think that it does suggest that there may have been some fully grown adults, or at least older adolescents, in the presence of other people who are clearly much smaller. Again, not having access to the article itself, I can't say for sure, but I think that it shows a range. But what they're focusing on then is that most of them are probably smaller. And so therefore, with some bigger people around and some smaller people around, the smaller people are most likely the children.
Yeah.
So I think they may actually be saying the same thing that you were saying about an adult helicoptering around while the little kids do their thing.
Nice. Yeah. Well, and yeah, so that would make sense. I guess I'll be a little less apprehensive on that statement. It does make sense then. So where does this fit in context of the, what they call the peopling of the Americas, which is probably the biggest question in archaeology and anthropology in the Americas today? Like the one unanswered question is, when were the first people here? And on the archaeology show a few years ago, I interviewed the author, the name escapes me, that wrote about the discovery that was made actually back in the 80s, I think it was, or maybe the 90s, during a highway project in California, San Diego, a road project where they found these cobbles that looked like they were made by humans with cut marks on like mastodon bones. The difference is here, or the problem with that was, it was dated to 125,000 years ago. So that's a long time. And that's way far back. But then we have, you know, the Topper site in South Carolina. We have Monte Verde, as Paul mentioned. We have the, oh, what is the other side?
Meadowcroft.
Yeah. We have all kinds of stuff that
there was that article a year and a half ago about the cave in northern Mexico that the dates there were, I think, around 27,000. But again, like I said earlier, all these other sites, it's the question revolves around whether or not it was people that did them.
It does. But when you start looking at these things and you start getting more and more and more evidence like this, you really start having to take a closer look at some of this stuff, you know? And the one thing that I thought was interesting about the site in San Diego that was 120,000 years ago, The author, the lead author on that, when we interviewed him, he said that one of the things they did was they sent images and I think 3D representations of the tools, so to speak, to other experts. They didn't tell them where they found them and they didn't tell them how old they were, but they said, yeah, these look like, you know, tools dated to around this time, found in Africa, you know, pretty common, that kind of thing. So there's no dispute, like Homo habilis and earlier, like Oldowan tools is one of the oldest tool assemblages in East Africa. And it was, I mean, these are 2 million year old tools, right? It's basically like you bang two rocks together, you make somewhat of a sharp edge and you do something with it, right? There's no form, there's no anything. You're just trying to get an edge you can do something with. And that was pretty common to even probably, you know, more ape-like species back in the day. I mean, that's a pretty obvious thing to do, is to bang two rocks together and get a sharp edge. So if, you know, hominids were doing that 2 million years ago, they were doing that for millions of years before they really started to get into it and start refining that in the last like 100,000 years or so, or 150,000 years in Europe and in Africa. If they were here, that's the question. If people came here, that technology, those ideas that are actually pretty easy to come across, that it's not like inventing the bow and arrow. You, this is a pretty easy thing to do. You're going to do it. If you need to eat and you're sitting there and you've got this big mastodon that you either killed or came upon and you want to eat it, well, you're going to find any way that you can. You're going to pull different rocks. And if you see a sharp edge on a rock, banging two rocks together to do that, or banging a bone between two rocks or something like that is going to be a pretty obvious thing to do. And yeah, I don't know. There's no, I guess where I was going with that is it's not questions whether hominids created Oldowan tool assemblages in Africa, but we find similar things over here in the Americas that date to 120,000 years. And instantly we question whether or not it's made by humans only because of its age and we don't have any other evidence.
Yeah. Well, because of what we know of with the environment at the time, you know, we know that people made it all the way out. I mean, Homo sapiens sapiens made it all the way out to Australia.
Yeah.
50, 60,000 years ago. Right. So people were spreading. It's just that to get from Asia to the Americas, you either have to cross a huge body of water or you have to find some way that is not covered in ice. And through most of the time period that they would be interested in, you know, so 50,000 years on, we've got ice ages. It blocks not just on this side. It's not just Beringia eastward, you know, not just the Americas, but it's also Siberia that's blocked.
Oh, yeah.
So there isn't a good way to get people from Southern Asia, where we know we have people, across to the Americas. And the best arguments in the past had been like during the ice-free corridor around 13,000 years ago, down through the middle, or else skirting the coasts and then moving inland once you're south of the glaciers. And I don't think anybody doubts that you could skirt the coast and go inland. It's just that because of the ice age, like you said earlier, the coast was way out there and is now totally submerged. And so we fear that we've lost most of the information. I don't think that the debate in our field is really about whether people could have or even whether they did, but whether what we're seeing is evidence of it.
Well, let's look at this then, right? When we were talking about the dating of this site that's in question here for this episode, we're referring to the last glacial maximum, indicating other glacial maximums, right? And some short research that I did, again, this isn't our specialty, is that for the last few million years, ice ages occurred approximately every 41,000 years. However, more recent evidence has shown that for about the last 800,000 years or so, it's been more like every 100,000 years. So if the last glacial maximum was around 20,000 to 25,000 years ago here in the Americas, the one before that would have been around 120, 125,000 years ago. So if you're looking at that, the same conditions would have presented themselves. Presumably, there may have been an ice-free corridor. They may have been a Bering land bridge. The question is, were there people in Siberia and, you know, Kazakhstan and that whole area up there at that time period that would have said, you know, hey, we're just moving here. Oh, look, more land. Let's go check that out. You know, let's go over here. We're following the beasts and they're going that way. There were people in that area. There were hominids at the very least. I don't know if they were Homo sapien, but you've got the Denisovans. You've got, you know, all kinds of people that are living in that area at that time. who's to say that there wasn't a first migration at that time period that came over that maybe didn't make it, right? And that's why we don't have a lot of evidence for it. But maybe they were here for even 10,000 years, but they had a very rudimentary tool assemblages. They didn't have anything else that would have lasted. None of the skins or wooden things that they would have done would have made it unless they were in a really well-preserved environment, which those are hard to find. So none of that would have made it. But we know we have evidence of people during that time in that area on the other side of the world. And if there was another glacial maximum 120,000 years ago, who's to say the same conditions didn't present themselves to get people here? And I don't know if they would have lived 80,000 years to the next glacial maximum of 20 to 25,000 years ago. Maybe that was enough to just say, that's it. Everybody's destroyed. And that's why we had the population explosion after mm-hmm. that started to end, because there were more people in Europe and Asia to come over, and they had higher technology, they had higher cognitive brain function, all those kinds of things to just bring more people in for the second wave. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's not completely unrealistic. So,
no, and that's a whole nother wrinkle that gets discussed. And I don't know who or how it's going to be answered, but
yeah.
How do you take account the possibility of, like you were saying, about small populations that came across earlier and then mm-hmm. didn't make it or were fully absorbed into later populations, that there wasn't like a critical mass of people until later periods? So it could be that mm-hmm. these footprints here are 21,000 years old, and there are definitely people and they were here, but they have no genetic relation to anybody else subsequently.
Right.
We don't know that. And right now it's all speculation. So again, like I said earlier, something like this, research like this, poses so many new questions that are all so interesting. And it's going to be up to people who are a lot smarter than I am to figure out how to ask them better and answer them better.
Indeed. It comes down to a place like White Sands, man. We probably know where the lake edges are. I don't know what kind of research has been done out there subsurface, but we probably have a pretty good idea of where the lake edges were at that time. They're digging in certain areas for a reason. You don't just dig randomly. So they're working on previous information, previous excavations, previous surveys, probably shovel testing to bring this full circle to the beginning. And we know a lot about that environment, presumably. So I think with this information and with this dating, I hope it invigorates research in that area, because the smoking gun is going to be human remains. I mean, if we can find human remains in association with these seeds or some other datable ethnobotanical material, paleoethnobotanical material, I mean, that is going to blow the Americas wide open from a research standpoint. It is going to change everything. So, mm-hmm. People might look back on this paper as really the time that a lot of thinking changed in this country. If this holds up, it's pretty exciting.
No, I think you're right.
So, well, that's about all we can say on this. Maybe we'll try to get one of the authors on to talk about this. That would be pretty cool. Somebody else. I'd love to get somebody to really come on and talk about carbon 14 dating. And because even though it's been around a long time, there are constant strides in what we can actually measure. I mean, they're counting the actual atoms with mass spectrometry, and it's accelerator mass spectrometry, AMS dating, they call it. They're literally just counting the atoms. So I don't think we can get any better at that. But I think the sample size has come down over the years as that's needed for that, as you're able to do that. Of course, the problem with smaller samples is contamination. You know, what's happened to that sample over the years? How was it collected? You know, all those sorts of things. Oh, and one thing I didn't mention, especially at White Sands, all of the radiocarbon dating is dated to, I believe, pre-1950. And 1950, I think, was the year that was decided that's when something says it's, let's say, 1,050 years old, that's 1,050 years from 1950, not from 2021. And the reason for that is the amount of carbon 14 that was basically created in the atmosphere as a result of massive amounts of nuclear testing, not just in this country, but around the world during the 40s and 50s. So it totally changed the curve for natural creation of carbon 14. And because of that, all our dates go to 1950.
Yeah. And so 1950, you'll often see dates represented as BP.
Yeah.
And that stands for before present, but present is 1950. And that's because archaeologists live in the past.
Exactly. I guess on that note, we'll call it.
Yeah, we stepped our foot in this, didn't we?
Indeed. Indeed. So anyway, if you're an expert in paleoethnobotany or carbon 14 dating or anything like that, want to come on the show, please contact us. Contact info in the show notes for this episode. So otherwise, thanks, Paul, for a great discussion on this.
Thanks, Chris. It's lots of fun.
All right. See you next week.
Take care. Thanks for listening to the Archaeotech Podcast. Links to items mentioned on the show are in the show notes at www.archpodnet.com/archaeotech. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and paul@lugol.com. Support the show by becoming a member at archpodnet.com/members. The music is a song called Off Road and is licensed free from Apple. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster and Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Come.